Hi, good morning everybody. This is The Naked Doctor. This is the show that lays it all bare in the medical profession. I'm Dr. Keith Scott-Mumby. I'm a British MD. Those of you who have not tuned into the program before, I'm sure you've seen the movie, The English Patient. You probably read the book, Michael Anagni's book, The English Patient. Anyway, I'm the English doctor. Now, this week we don't have our medical psychic, Flora Powers. She's out of town. I suspect she's gone off to a witch's coven somewhere. Well, on a broomstick. Well, these days, of course, the girls like to call themselves white witches. But if you look at the history of this, it's not quite so funny. The witches were treated very badly in the past. In fact, a lot of them were just simply wise old women, and they had good intuition, and some of them, of course, got results, and that would have been pretty dangerous because then the local physicians would feel threatened. So I'm sure in those days witch hunt applied just the same as today, that if you're not part of the herd and you stand out and suggest that what they're doing may not work so well, then you're likely to find yourself on the receiving end of a witch hunt. That's nothing. The church, of course, had rather a bad down on the ladies, the witches. It was considered satanic. But I must say, I have difficulty with a church that feels it's satanic when a wise old woman says, take this herb, and somebody recovers. And yet it's perfectly happy with the medical profession, doesn't denounce it publicly as seriously satanic when it kills about 500,000 people a year by clumsiness, stupidity, and frankly, interventions that are just unnecessary, motivated entirely by money. And just to ram home that point, let me start as usual with some little news item that tells you what it's really like in the medical profession these days. A study just been published showing that percutaneous coronary intervention, that's a posh word for things like stents and angioplasty, in other words, messing around trying to patch up and repair arteries if somebody has bad arteries. Don't try and fix the problem. Don't change the person's diet or exercise. Just replace the artery, and of course it comes back. Anyway, there's a study done to see whether that really was effective overall, and comparing just medical treatment, passive medical treatment, no surgical intervention of any kind, with the surgical intervention. And in this study, there were over 2,000 patients, nearly 2,300 patients. It was over a five-year period. There were 1,150 patients assigned to undergo surgery, the stents and the angioplasty-type procedures, and 1,138 were opted to just receive medical therapy alone. That's drug treatments and non-interventional treatments, anyway. And over 5 years, they studied the primary outcome. Now, primary outcome meant death from any cause, or a repeat non-fatal myocardial infarction. Myocardial infarction is the posh word for a heart attack, right? And guess what? It's very interesting. In the group that received surgery, there were 211 primary events. And in the group that had no surgical intervention, there were only 202 events. Well, of course, statistically speaking, that means they're pretty much the same. But in fact, slightly less. Slightly less likely to die and slightly less likely to have a repeat if you did nothing than if you went in for surgery. Well, with results like this, of course, what should happen is the surgeons all throw in the scalpels and say, hey guys, it's not working, we no need to do this procedure anymore. I wouldn't hold your breath. I don't think there's really any chance of such a thing happening. They're making far too much money. They're making billions of dollars on cardiac and arterial surgery, and it's not going to finish anytime soon just because it's been proven to be a waste of time. Really, this has little to do with science and medicine, you know. This is a point I keep making on the show. It's a lot more to do with sales and marketing. They just kind of sell the idea that that's always the way it's been. We earn our money that way. And they're not going to be sidetracked by mere issues like science. Okay, we're going to go on and talk about alternatives to all that kind of thing. Little point in criticizing unless you can suggest something better. Questions today, if you've got questions, please call in. I'm always happy to answer live questions, and especially if you've got some comments on the material for today's show. The call-in number is 327-0977. 760 if you're outside the family, outside the valley. 327-0977. Okay, today I thought I'd talk about my five pillars of wellness and healthy aging. Pretty much the same thing, really. I have a saying that any good health measure is an anti-aging measure. It seems pretty logical to me. The more you take care of yourself, the longer you're likely to live. And of course, it's not just a question of how long you live, but how well you live, the quality of life. Not necessarily more years, but more active and productive years. We might call this successful aging, if you like, and these pillars really amount to a science of successful aging, if you like. We can look at it in different dimensions. It's not just, as I say, simply how long you live, but we've got biological and physical wellness, you know, whether you're fit, whether you can walk comfortably, breathe easily. Think of the various things that you see in elderly folk that might befall them. It's best not to. And of course, it's not part of aging. It's very important to understand it's not part of aging to be doddery and crippled and senile. There are far too many people make it to 100, 110 and still have their faculties all about them. They can still walk. In some interesting and extreme societies, people actually go on riding horses and walking up mountains and things well past the age of 100. So aging of itself doesn't do all these things. That's a misconception sold to us by the medical profession. You know, you go along with aches and complaints and rheumatism, and the doctor says, well, you're 60 years old, what do you expect? Your answer should be, I expect better than that, because it's not part of the process of aging at all. In fact, you could say that really nobody dies of aging. People only die of diseases. I mean, you're more likely to get them as you get older. That's all. Okay, that's the biological and physical wellness idea. But we've also got the idea of environmental wellness. That's our... So I don't mean environmental in the sense of, pollutants and, biochemical things. That really belongs in the physical fitness section. I'm talking about our mental environment, really. Relationships... the people around you, the satisfaction at work and so on, how you get on with people. I mean, there's little point in saying you're fit and healthy and well if you're living in a stressful environment, which is, likely to see you, I mean, maybe die young, you know, you're in a war zone or something like that. That's not exactly healthy, is it? Come on. Relationships are very important to this, you know, how we relate to people, and probably our loving relationships, i.e. family, are the most important aspect of that. And it's one which, sadly, a lot of us get wrong. There are happy, loving, comfortable families, but there are also an awful lot of dysfunctional families where one or other members are beating on each other and making life very difficult. Emotions and storms in the family life and so on can be very difficult. Another pillar of healthy aging or wellness into your later years has to do with, it's hard to define it in words, really, but let's say it has to do, I think, with achievement. What you've got in life, where you end up, in other words, whether you have a life that's comfortable, you've got the kind of surroundings that you would like, sufficient wealth, I guess, and not necessarily being rich, but sufficient physical wealth to live the kind of life that you want. And along with that comes self-esteem. You know, did you really succeed in the things that you were interested in? My wife Vivian and I watched a movie last night with Jack Nicholson. It's called About Schmidt. I don't know if you've seen this movie. It's actually a very dreary, rather drab movie, but it has a very strong point to make. It's a man who reaches the age of 65. He's an insurance salesman. And all of a sudden, he's retired. He's out on the scrap heap. Jack Nicholson plays this character brilliantly. I mean, so brilliantly, it makes you want to slash your wrists. It was so miserable. but he was very good at portraying a man completely lost and bereft. He's retired, lost his job, lost all his meaning. And then all of a sudden, his wife dies, so he's lost his marriage. His whole life ends up in a heap of trash in a very short spell. That's the first sort of 25% of the movie, and then the rest of it follows how he works all this out. His daughter gets married, rather against his wishes, and disappears, kind of, you know. I mean, people don't exactly disappear from your life. But when a child marries and moves on, there's a big severance takes place with the parents. So he lost her too, and the last few minutes of the movie got to the point where he's saying, really, my life, you know, whatever way you look at it, my life was a failure, it was a disaster, nothing. But there is one tiny little shining light at the end that brings some light to the whole dreary concept. And if you haven't seen the movie, do, because the last few seconds make up for 2.5 hours of gloom and doom. It's rather good. Okay, now another aspect of healthy aging, or just general wellness, remember I keep making this point, healthy aging is healthy living. We might call this faith and meaning. These kind of things have been studied, believe it or not, in relation to survival, disease, and longevity. And in fact, I'm going to talk about that. That's going to be today's main topic, if you like, to look back over that. Whether you can, you know what I mean? It's kind of how you fit into the world, how you see a place, how you understand the unfolding of fate and the things that happen to us, whether you've got beliefs that make you strong in adversity, or whether you're just buffeted and kicked around by the storm. And then lastly, of the five, probably the most important, well, a critical one, shall we say. Most important might be the wrong way to put it, but emotional health, very critical. There is no question that emotions and stress are deadly. They kill us faster than anything. People who live very stressful lives do not survive as long. They tend to contract disease and die young. It's as simple as that. In medicine, we have a very simple way of measuring that. We measure a hormone called cortisol. And the higher a person's cortisol levels, the more under stress they are, the more you can practically work it out. So many milligrams in the blood means so many years off your life. People like doing that kind of maths, and I suppose somebody's done it somewhere. I'll report back if I ever find the figures. But I can tell you a very good example of that, which is the Pacific salmon. When it migrates up the rivers, it goes through tremendous stress, and its cortisol levels raise by 2,000 or 3,000. You know the story. The salmon battles its way up to the head of the river, sheds its eggs and spawns, and then just simply dies. The salmon has aged. In a matter of 2 weeks, it's aged years, caused by these horrendously high cortisol levels. So there's a good moral for us folk that we do not wish to see cortisol in our blood, whatever happens. Okay, now I said I'd probably pick up on one. In fact, over the weeks, maybe I'll take each of those kind of topics in turn. They might make a good subject for a program. Anyway, if you've got any comments on what I've said so far, and before I move on to my main topic, questions, the number to call in is 3270977. And not just questions, but if you want to make a comment too, I'm going to be making some comments, some strong points about faith and belief, and you know what part that plays in our life, particularly from a doctor's point of view and health point of view. And if you have some experiences you want to share, it doesn't need to be a question, just phone in and tell me I'm right, or phone in and tell me I'm wrong. I don't mind. We can start a debate that way. Okay, so we're going to take a little break for our first of our sponsors. A new subject here, very interesting one, this, the Rife microscope, it's called. Anyway, listen to our broadcast here.
Was cancer cured back in 1934 with electronic frequencies? Who was this man named Royal Raymond Rife? And if his work was so significant, where is it now? Royal Rife was a hard-working and very industrious man who built an ultra-powerful microscope that allowed him to view living cells. He figured out that every microorganism resonates at a very specific frequency, and that the right frequency can dissolve these microorganisms like an opera singer breaks a wine glass. He worked with prominent doctors of his time and worked extensively with cancer. So what happened to this medical discovery? Was it squashed by the American Medical Association? Or is this just another conspiracy theory that should be ignored? My name is Joshua Parker, and I've been researching the work of Royal Raymond Rife for a number of years. I've put together a free e-course that you can download today by visiting electrodetox.com. That's electrodetox.com. Go there today and check out this free e-course. Whether you've heard of Rife before or if this is brand new to you, you'll find the information in my e-course to be vitally important for your education on this subject. I cover information that you won't see elsewhere from trustworthy sources such as legal documents and rare audio tapes. Visit www.electrodetox.com and learn the real history behind what this mysterious man named Royal Raymond Rife really accomplished, and how this technology may affect the future of your health.
Hi, folks. Yes, welcome back. I can tell you I know young Joshua, a great guy, and what he's found and compiled is very interesting. I have the materials myself, and I found them absolutely fascinating, and it's one of those classic stories of brilliant discoveries getting submerged by commercial interests and almost lost sight of, but not quite lost sight of. You have researchers like Joshua to bring it to public view. While we're on the subject of sponsors, I'd just like to mention my good friends again at the Pepper Tree Bookstore, the Valley's number one bookstore. Well, there are two number one bookstores now. I guess that means their one and two slots are one equal, first equal. They have a new store down in La Quinta, which is gorgeous, down in the old town of La Quinta, right by all the wine bars and the restaurants. So you can go out and have lunch and get your intellectual feed and your intellectual nourishment too from a book. The old bookstore is still down there on Lower Palm Canyon in downtown Palm Springs, just there as it was. And they're great and they're very helpful. It's not just like the ones that start with B, the big bookshops, all their names start with B, but pretty impersonal and pretty overwhelming, frankly. A nice eclectic mix and choice of books there, and Charles and Chris and their staff, very helpful, very pleased to look after you. So don't forget, go and buy your books in the Pepper Tree Bookstore. Now, this is Keith Scott Mumby, the naked doctor, stripping it all bare in the medical profession. And I've moved on for today to the subject of faith and meaning as it applies in a medical context. I'm not evangelizing in any way, but it's very interesting that it has health. Well, I suppose it's inevitable. It has health connotations, how you see yourself and how you feel about life, how you respond to illness, in fact. All comes down to really what faith and meaning you have in life. And when I say faith, I don't mean what religious denomination you belong to, but whether you really believe in the meaning of all things and whether it has any comfort or importance to you. If you think that we're just kind of bodies and blobs like insects, I guess you would find it not very comforting. You must see the prospect of a life of more or less steady decline after the age of 21 and more or less inevitable illness and absolutely inevitable death, it would be rather gloomy. So this is the point to make, really, is that some kind of faith and having some kind of meaning to attach to life is very important. Now, I say right away that I don't mean, for example, that you must have the right God to be healthy. There are lots of gods out there, or maybe it's all one God. I'm not saying that. It's just perhaps important to believe in a God, or at least some sense of higher values. I think, you know, it's no good saying, well, I'm happy and healthy and well and I don't believe in God, because you could be missing out on something. You know, the old story of the agnostic who didn't really believe in God, but he said, I go to church anyway just in case I'm wrong. It's kind of like that. You might find that you made a mistake and that it becomes important to you later, and that you were, you know, you wasted time or years by not really taking this issue on board. Certainly, whether you call it God or whether you visualize a God, as people describe it, or not, it is important, I think, that we have a sense of higher values in our life, that there's some higher meaning to it all, that there's some architecture behind the whole thing. It isn't some haphazard chemical and mechanical accident. I don't think that's a very difficult concept. You know, the physicists that think about the Big Bang starting it all, and they believe that means we're just living in a mechanical universe. I just don't know how they can even pretend to be logical, because even a child is going to start asking the question, well, who caused the Big Bang? Or where did that come from? And if you say, well, there was something else that led to the initial small lump of matter that exploded, what led to that, and so on. It's like Aristotle's old question of why was that? Well, okay, why was that? And so on. You go backwards and backwards, and pretty soon you have to get to some concept that's a little bit beyond words, a little bit beyond simple explanation, that gives that deeper feeling that there's something more wondrous and more amazing than just ourselves. Now, remember, I am talking about faith and meaning. I'm not talking about religion. Freud was a very obnoxious man in many ways, as you know, although a very clever man, and a lot of what he said was true. But he dismissed religion. He called it a universal obsessional neurosis. Well, he was right in one sense, in that it's not, if not quite universal, it's certainly pretty common. But I think his dismissal of it in those terms is really pretty poor, and shows that he probably didn't have these values himself, poor guy, and that was what he was missing out on. So, it's really talking about his own stuff rather than being scientific wisdom about the way life really was. I'd like you to compare that with the words of another great man called Paracelsus. Well, he called himself Paracelsus, but his actual name, if you're interested, is, and wait for this, it's Philippus Theophrastus Aureolus Bombastus von Hohenheim. and he lived in the 16th century. He called his name Paracelsus because the writings of Celsus, the Roman physician from 1500 years before, had just come to the surface and were quite fashionable. So he took the short name of Paracelsus, thank goodness. Anyway, he's much remembered and much loved because he's a very radical figure in medical history. He didn't like the way doctors and physicians were behaving. He thought they were, he called them, I can't remember the exact expression, but he annoyed them all. There was mixes of porridge, I think he said. I thought they only the Scots ate porridge in those days, but apparently the Germans and the French and the Swiss knew it too. But anyway, Paracelsus said that a physician should have spiritual perception. He should have spiritual knowledge and spiritual power. And that spiritual power, I wonder if that he was thinking along the lines of things like our psychic flora powers, you know, that he could manifest things, you know, make things happen. Everybody, I think, these days knows about manifesting. You know, it's usually attached to getting rich instead of being attached to all the better things in life. But, you know if you believe it, or the power of attraction and so on. So those are spiritual powers. If you have sufficient faith in your spirit and the energies of that and what you want, that you can actually bring it about. So I guess that's what he meant by spiritual power. Anyway, one day I think I'll perhaps talk a bit more about Paracelsus, because he was a very gifted person, and as I say, much loved these days by everyone who practices any kind of medical alternative. But he was very very anti the mainstream of his day. Hey, so am I. Maybe I'm a reincarnation of him. Anyway, so the point I'm looking at, remember, is belief and spirit and faith and these wonderful things in relation to survival and health. We're talking about aging. Anyone got any comments on this, by the way? Do call in. Happy to hear your comments or any questions. The call-in number is 3270977. I hope I'm not making this so interesting that nobody has questions. What I'd like to do actually is share with a couple of listeners, just debate it a little bit really. I'm sure people have these kind of experiences I'm going to be referring to, and I'd like you to share it with us if you would. A man called Dr. Michael McCulloch in 2000 did what's called a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis means you heap everything into a great big heap and combine all the figures and look at a much bigger picture. And he was studying people who were involved in the religious sense, people who went to church, people who had beliefs. And he found something extraordinary, which is that they were 30% less likely to die in a given time frame. This was published in a famous paper in a journal called Health Psychology. A meta-analysis is a combination of studies, but one of the studies that McCulloch used was by a man called Strawbridge, and that was done right here in California, Alameda County. He studied 5,200 residents from Alameda County and found that people with religious conviction had a 36% lower mortality rates. That's pretty significant. You know, as I joked, I think it was either last week or the week before, if you can do 2% better than placebo, you can claim your drug is proven, you can go out and make millions, even if it's a bunch of junk. If they could find a drug that would reduce the death rate by 36%, I think there would be lots of jubilation in the medical profession. We can't come anywhere near that with conventional medical interventions. And yet just the simple power of belief and participation. Of course, we have to be cautious scientifically in interpreting that. Maybe it's the case that the people who go to church and get involved are kind of good, decent, clean living people. They're less likely to mess themselves up with drugs and promiscuous sex and all that kind of thing. That could be a factor, so it needs bringing in as a consideration and a possibility. But in fact, when I checked the studies that were available and looked at that, you can see quite clearly that it's what you might call dose-related. If it was a drug, you'd say the more of the drug, the better the result. That's what we mean by dose-related. Well, it isn't a drug, of course, but a study of 20,000 people compared used a very simple standard of faith and commitment, if you like, which is just did they attend church regularly. And the gold standard, as it were, they chose were people who attended twice a week or more. Those were considered the seriously committed people. Well, those who only went to church once a week had 18% more mortality. That's interesting. If the person went less than once a week, so not even that much commitment, Then it rose to a 31% higher chance of mortality and disaster. And most interesting of all, if the person never ever went to church, they had a shocking 87% higher death rate than those who went to church twice a week. Well, does that mean that going to church protects you? I don't know what it means. As I say, it could mean something about the psychology of people that go to church. For example, it could mean that you're participating in a group, you've got the comfort of belonging, you're surrounded by friends. But certainly, you know, belief and an interpretation of some kind of meaning in life must be important to those people too. It's kind of, as I said, dose related. I think that's what tells us that it's the religious commitment too. It's not just simply belonging. In fact, you can use this kind of participation, as it were, these kind of figures, how often a person goes to church or how committed they are, to predict all kinds of things, illness rates. It will predict immune status. There's more immune response and better status for those who go to church than those who don't. It will predict emotional wellness. It will even predict use of hospital services. They tend to find themselves in hospital less often if they're religious people. Excuse me if I'm, you know, preaching to the converted, of course. You might think, well, this is all obvious. But it isn't obvious scientifically. You know, there's still a lot of heated debate. There are doctors saying it's got nothing to do with medicine. You know, we should keep out of it. There are even some doctors who say, I think this is all mumbo-jumbo, getting people to pray and doing all this kind of stuff. That could be very negative. That could undo all our good work with the drugs and surgery. You wouldn't believe the level of debate that's going on out there. Religious involvement is associated with lower depression scores, believe it or not, better adjustment to transplant surgery, and it even lowers blood pressure. The more involved you are, the lower the average blood pressure of people involved. Interesting, that's most especially amongst black people. The difference, in other words, between the religiously committed people and black people of both types, it shows up more strongly in African Americans, which I think is very interesting. Let's take another break.
Are you searching for secret ancient natural remedies and non-invasive technologies to restore the fountain of youth? Then look no more. At the Chari Center of Health, we treat medical and psychological conditions using highly effective natural remedies, remarkable mind-body techniques, and the most innovative breakthroughs in quantum technologies. The many benefits of coming to the Chari Center include reversing the aging process, quickly and easily reduce weight, instantly release stress, restore energy, health, and vitality, release addictions, cravings, and eliminate self-destructive behaviors. To see an exciting brief movie of how to transform your life with these amazing futuristic quantum technologies, please visit our website at www.charicenter.com. Again, that's www.charicenter.com, and you'll be glad you did.
Yes, hi, welcome back. This is the Naked Doctor, laying it all bare, and today I'm talking about faith and meaning, how that applies to health. The overall topic I've called the five pillars of wellness and healthy aging. We'd all like to live longer, but it's not just important to live longer, it's important to have a better and healthier life. And as I've been saying, there's really very little doubt, a little argument that having some deeper beliefs about life is very protective and will help you with disease. You're more likely to die of a heart attack, you're more likely to die of cancer and other diseases if you're not involved in some way. One of the simplest measures is just simply measure or count how often a person goes to church and just take that as a measure of religious commitment. Of course, there are a lot of people who don't go to church at all but may still be deeply committed in the religious sense. But it's all very important. It shows that you have fewer heart attacks, your immune system is better, you're going to have less use of hospital services. and it will even lower blood pressure. So I think one would be quite justified in saying that God is good for you, even if you didn't believe it from the scriptures. At least, at any rate, a belief in God is good for you. And I was thinking, for the show, that maybe music comes in here too. Music is a kind of other dimensional thing. I'm not saying it's divine, but, you know, it's got that mystery and meaning of life element, hasn't it? I don't mean, you know, rap and loud, noisy music. I'm talking about, spiritual music that enlivens and engages the soul. Maybe that's an important element to us too. I know a lot of us that enjoy music at the deeper level do feel it's doing something positive towards our attitude to life and our beliefs about self and our picture of the universe. So all that's important. So what it really comes down to, and I said meaning, finding meaning. We're not concerned here what religion you might be. That's not the issue. The issue is finding some meaning in life and finding the positive. I think that's very important, that people who've gone through experiences in life, if they have a religious view of things or a spiritual view of things, are able to find a positive view in everything. And I would commend that very highly to you as one of the number one aging techniques of all, if you like, which is whatever has happened to you, even if it seems bad, you know, look for the positive, look for the good in that. There's a great old Persian proverb, I don't know if you've heard of it, the darker the sky, the brighter the stars will shine. And that sort of expresses that mentality very well, that in everything that looks dark and gloomy, there may be, you know, the old silver lining, in the darkest cloud there's a silver lining. That sort of idea, I call it the Zorba the Greek mentality. I don't know if you can remember back to that movie, Zorba the Greek. I think it was Anthony Quinn. Anyway, a Greek guy who had a great attitude to life. And at the end of the movie, he's lost everything. Instead of falling on his knees and crying and moping and feeling sorry for himself, he goes out on the beach and he dances his heart out. And that's where that terrific Zorba the Greek music comes from. It was his dance. And that's the way to respond, really, whatever tough breaks you get. If you can bounce back, that means you're healthy and viable, and it means you're going to live a lot longer than the average person. Hey, nobody's called in today. No questions, I understand. Maybe you're waiting to hear all this fascinating stuff. But anyone got anything to share with me here? You know, some experience? I'm going to talk in a minute about some... Well, let me talk now and invite some comments, because I would like people with experiences of this, if they'd share them with us. What we call the dark night of the soul. It's a bit like the Zorba the Greek idea, but at a deeper level. This term comes from a Christian mystic called St. John of the Cross. And it's a metaphorical concept where a person has gone down into the depths of Hades, as it were. Their personal life has collapsed to the point of desperation and misery and despair, gone through blackness and gloom, and then come out the other side. It's not just that they go through the bad experience. The whole point of the metaphor is that the other side, the person is different. The person is energized and feels special. And it's almost a quantitative thing, you know, the bigger the crash, the bigger the disaster, the more the person gets from it, the recovery process brings its own rewards. And I would say pretty well everyone has to go through this experience at some time in their life. I was pretty lucky, mine didn't come till my 50s, but, you know, I got my share, same as everybody else. I thought I was doing good. In fact, my son was very comforting when it happened, and he said, you know, Dad, everything's been good for you. You've hardly ever had any tough times, and now you've got one. Maybe it's good for you. Very wise words from a youngster, my own youngster. So anyone who can share ideas with that would be much appreciated. It can happen. Disasters can befall us in the blink of an eye. It doesn't have to be very long. You know, one morning you can go to the doctors and find that you're diagnosed with cancer, and the dark blinds come down and the fear and the terror strikes. And all of a sudden that you find that you're in a very difficult place. But, you know, if you can find... I'm talking about finding the good in these things. And, in fact, an awful lot of people do. I have a saying which I think I shared with you on the program. I began talking about cancer alternatives. I mean, there's so much to say about cancer alternatives. I'll need 3 or 4 programs. I will get back to that theme. But a lot of people who end up in that place say that it's the best thing that happened to them. It's as I said, my saying is that it's not a death knell. Cancer is not a death knell, but it's certainly a wake-up call. It says there's something wrong, and you're going to have to fix it, otherwise you might well find your time on Earth is finished. And a lot of people, of course, do. This has got nothing to do with the chemotherapy, the radiotherapy, or whatever else the person does. I'm talking about inwards, in the heart and soul. And a lot of cancer people have reported very positive things. They said they suddenly woke up to life. They suddenly began to appreciate the meaning of life. They suddenly appreciated how much they love people next to them, who they were maybe taking for granted. You know, there's nothing more certain to make you miss somebody and value them if they go and die on you, or they suddenly walk out, if it's a relationship and they walk out on you. You're suddenly brought face to face with the fact that you really cared for them very much, even if you forgot to say so. All these kind of things can happen to somebody who's stricken with illness. Cancer survivors, and those are the most likely to survive, they often tell this kind of story. They take a renewed interest in health and vitality. It needn't be as serious as cancer. I mean, I heard a story only yesterday, somebody with asthma who was well overweight didn't pay any attention whatsoever to his health, but in his 50s suddenly had a severe asthma attack on a plane, almost died, got to an emergency room. And it was a very terrifying experience. But as a result of that, he said, hey, I'm going to have to do something with myself. I can't go on like this. I'm about 50, 60 pounds overweight. So he began to work out, went on a diet, lost weight, feels better now than he's felt in 30 years, and says, yes, you know, that was the great thing that happened to me. It was a wake-up call. And although at the time it seemed very dark and frightening and gloomy, then in fact it turned out to be a very bright light that switched on. It helped bring me back from the cliff edge. And I shall live a lot longer as a result. So bear that in mind, okay? And that you can actually study these things quantitatively. It's been done, scientific studies. They call this soft science often, but to me it's just equally valid to ask people questions like this and statistize your results and turn them into figures. But, for example, I learned that 50% of stroke victims say, and 45% of their caregivers, incidentally, because they have to be brought into the picture. You know, the caregivers and family are part of the story. In fact, this is a very important issue with cancer. You know, we all feel sorry for the person who's diagnosed with cancer, but we should feel equally sorry for the family because they're in line for a disaster, especially if the cancer sufferer dies. They're left to survive the shock and the bereavement, and they have a pretty tough break too. So don't forget the caregivers. Anyway, in stroke victims, half the stroke victims were good, and so, almost the same number of caregivers, 45%, found something positive. That doesn't mean they were glad it happened or, you know, would choose it again, but it means given that these circumstances took place, they were happy to find something of deeper meaning in that. And patients who have bone marrow transplants, now if you, I don't know if you know this procedure, but it's one of the grimmest of all medical procedures. It's very horrible to undergo. And the chances of dying actually are quite high. I mean, it's supposed to be a medical treatment, but it can be a pretty disastrous one. An awful ordeal, in other words. But even 70% of people who'd gone through that when interviewed had found something positive. And I like that. You know, that's the kind of attitude of survivors. Those are people who will overcome life's obstacles, and those are the ones that will, in the end, go on living longer than average. That's the way to be. HIV, AIDS sufferers, another study showed 83% reported something positive. Again, the typical thing, the typical story, appreciation of loved ones, a renewed interest in lifestyle and health. You know, waking up feeling every day is beautiful and special because you were, you know, you're pleased to have had it, and you know, you may not have had it. I'm writing a book, but one of the sections on that book is going to be called "I Want Inviting to Your 100th Birthday Party." That's about anti-aging. But you know, over my career of 30 years in the UK, I got invited to so many birthday parties for people who said, "I wouldn't be having this birthday if it wasn't for you. So you must come. You're going to be guest of honor." And that's really great, I must say. I made more friends. The way I practice medicine, made more friends, lasting friends who still communicate with me than ever, you know, in any other kind of medicine. I mean, I wouldn't go back to the old conventional way. Statistics I've been hearing recently, the average visit to the doctor, the primary care doctor, is in the space of like 5 or 10 minutes at the most. But you know, that somebody's made a study and found out that the doctor has decided on the diagnosis and what he's going to be prescribing in 18 seconds. It takes him 18 seconds to categorize you, dismiss you, if you like, and start writing out the prescription. So anything you say after that anyway is a waste of time because he's already made up his mind. he or she, I should say, of course, let's not get sexist about this. One last idea, preterm birth, you know, giving birth to premature babies. 70% of mothers found something rewarding or positive about that extra special love and care. In the University of Miami, they studied cortisol. Remember I mentioned cortisol hormone before? That's the stress hormone. It's the one that kills us. Well, they took two groups of breast cancer patients, split them in half. One group was given therapy and counseling and discussion, and you know, they shared with the group and they came to terms and understanding and, you know, gained a command or a perspective over the illness that was somewhat protective, shall we say. They had significantly lower cortisol levels. Well, that's great for the cancer patients. They should all do that. But doesn't it say that everybody else should too? We all want lower cortisol levels, not just, remember I told you about the Pacific salmon. We all want lower cortisol, trust me. The University of Connecticut studied 279 male heart attack patients and found again many positive effects in their responses to that. They had these were the ones that showed up at top. Renewed interest in lifestyle, appreciation of life and loved ones, changes, positive changes in values and meanings. And interestingly, those with this kind of comment in an 8-year follow-up were shown that they were less likely to have a repeat. So it all comes down to the same thing, folks. Faith and meaning and attitude, a positive view of life, is very helpful and protective medically. Okay.
Do you want unbiased information on medical alternatives that's trustworthy and not by someone trying to sell you their products? Well, then subscribe now to Dr. Keith's Wholesome Living Letter with reliable, up-to-date facts properly evaluated. It's advice presented in a clear, concise, simple, and easily understandable manner. With Dr. Keith's vast knowledge of both medical therapies and alternatives, you'll be able to make up your own mind for treatments for you and your loved ones in sickness or in health. Get Dr. Keith's Wholesome Living Letter now by calling 760-325-0105. That's 325-0105. Or go to the internet at the website, wholesomelivingletter.com. That's all one word, wholesomelivingletter.com. And start living a wholesome and healthy life.
Hi, welcome back to the Naked Doctor Show. We have a call. We've got BJ from Palms. I know who this is. BJ, come on. Hi, good morning. What have you got to share with us?
Good morning, Dr. Keith. Just a question. You talked about cortisol levels.
And yes.
What's the best method and how does the person go about testing them?
Through a physician or a compounding pharmacy would be one way to do it. But, you know, there are laboratories where you can send off saliva specimens. There's one I like to quote on this program, Diagnostics, or I think in Seattle, in the northwest somewhere anyway. The website is diagnostics.com. That's www. And it's diagnostics.com. So it's kind of not quite an acronym, but anyway, it's a pun on their word, Diagnostics, as a diagnostics. They do saliva tests. They're very inexpensive, and a person should get one of those if they're concerned about that. Yeah?
So saliva is the best test.
It's the simplest and the cheapest, and it's pretty accurate. You know, they compared it very favorably and very accurately with blood levels, so that's a particularly good one. Not all is good in the saliva, but that cortisol is.
Great. Well,
okay, thanks for that.
Great
okay.
Show.
Anyone else, if you've got questions, please call in. Or if you've got any dark nights of the soul to share with us, give me a call and tell us about it if you don't mind. That's 327-0977. And we're talking about spirituality and beliefs and faith and meaning and how those relate to medical issues. I'm not trying to get on any kind of religious soapbox and make a point from that point of view. I'm just saying it does you good medically, therefore it makes sense, it's common sense. And it may be partly that just that you are belonging to a group that shares similar beliefs, so you feel loved and belonging, or it may be that the faith itself sustains and elevates you. I believe the latter is very important. But you know, the medical profession is still arguing. Listen, we just have a call come in. Let's talk to Lisa. Where does Lisa? Hello, Lisa. Lisa, which city? Hello, Lisa. Which city?
Hello, on Palm Springs.
Oh yes, hi. Welcome.
We truly do need you in this town.
Nice of you to say so.
I think you should hang a shingle up in your office. Happiness is my business. Doctor, you remember Bruno McFadden?
No. Who is Bruno McFadden?
He was the first physical culturist in the United States, and he opened up the first health food store.
Oh, tell you fill me in. Remember, I'm from Europe. I know.
Yeah, well,
same kind of storylines in Europe.
London.
Yes.
He was more famous in London than the United States.
How long ago is this?
That was about 60 years ago.
Ah, okay. I'm only 60 years old, so he was before my time, I can healthily say.
Yeah. But he was he was even bigger than Randolph Hearst in the United States.
Nobody was bigger than Randolph Hearst. You'll have to be shot for saying that.
Oh, no. Randolph Hearst hated him.
Oh, I'm not saying Randolph Hearst is a nicer man. I'm just saying he was
a big guy. Entire Hearst
he was
family.
A big jerk, in fact. Not a big guy. I was just I said big, then I realized I meant to say big jerk.
Yeah,
just a big man.
He had all these physical culture magazines out. He started the Life magazine, the Liberty magazine, all the true stories that are on the market now.
Oh, right.
Hearst was very jealous of him.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, anything in publishing, it's like the Rockefellers. They considered it was a sin that anyone else was in their market.
Yeah.
They didn't want any competition, and as I heard some stories, they bombed the competition if they didn't
but
like
anyhow,
it.
But anyhow, Doctor, I want to thank you for coming to Palm Springs and wish you a lot of happiness.
That's great.
Thank you for all that you're doing. I've heard so many wonderful stories about you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, if you just said heard stories, I'd say, don't worry, I'll get my lawyer on it. But if they're wonderful stories,
and thanks
I'm
for
always
telling
pleased
everyone
to hear.
This morning that the answer to longevity and life is meant for living.
Absolutely.
Thank you kindly.
Okay. Thanks very much, Elise, for those comments. That's great. Anyone else? There's still time for one or two comments before the end. And I'm especially anxious if anyone wants to share A Dark Night of the Soul, just to make the point, as it were, so that we all understand it better. Otherwise, I might end up telling my story. And you don't really want that, do you? But it was just to illustrate it. Anyway, as I said, there is debate. A lot of doctors have trouble accepting this, or they think, what's it got to do with us? You know, you say, hey, buddy, you know, people feel better, never mind if they live longer. But even if you're really not getting the message, look at these figures, they really do live longer. What do you mean it's got nothing to do with us, you know? But they argue. We're beginning to make cracks in the armour, as it were. For example, and it's only an example, I'm sure there are many others, but the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School now runs a course called Spirituality and Medicine, and it teaches students how to talk to patients about faith and illness. It's important, because even if the doctor himself isn't a believer or a carer, it might apply to patients. So it's not good enough to say, oh, I don't believe in all that God stuff, because the patient might, and you're there as the physician. You're supposed to be there to help and comfort. And in fact, a Newsweek poll showed that 72% of Americans said that they would welcome a conversation with their physicians about faith. Do you think they would get it? I don't think it's very likely. Out of that 72%, I doubt if even 1% or 2% were happy and got anything from that. Anyway, if that's something that's important to you and your own physician doesn't want to play ball, you can participate. The internet now is a great instrument. It's got enormous healing properties, as well as all that disgusting spam stuff and pornography stuff and all those things you've heard about. It has tremendous healing powers too, because the internet connects people of like mind and like beliefs. It's quite wonderful out there. And there's something like, I believe, I've got figures here that says 35,000 online prayer circles. That's how seriously, you know, people take this. And they pray for each other. They pray for their loved ones. They pray for total strangers. And you can log on and you can send an electronic prayer. All this would have seemed almost unimaginable. Well, it was unimaginable 50 years ago, but almost unimaginable 25 years ago. And yet, you know, it has importance and has meaning to us, and this is the way that people get connected. Remember I said that faith and belief and meaning might have to do with being connected, just being connected and feeling you're part of, the human race and sharing things with others. There's a business tycoon, a British guy called Sir John Templeton, made a pile in mutual fund insurance. That's investments, isn't it? Mutual funds. Anyway, he spends apparently 30 million sterling. That's now over $50 million. It's getting on for $60 million, in fact, at the moment. The dollar's so bad. Every year, he spends that funding scientific projects to explore the nature of God and the meaning of life. The National Institutes of Health here in the US is spending several millions a year now looking at the bigger picture they call mind-body medicine. But I mean, some of it is simply religious and obviously from mainly a Christian perspective. They're studying things like prayer. And lots of doctors who are, there's a neurologist called Dr. Andrew Newberg. He's from the University of Pennsylvania, who was pretty unconvinced and pretty uncommitted. And yet when he started looking at this, he realized there was a tremendous lot to it. And he said, there's been this big shift. And he said, and I quote him, that people like me are very intrigued by what we're seeing. If you have an open mind, and scientists should have an open mind, unfortunately not many do, they should be aware that these possibilities are important to us, and it can have a great impact. It's no good arguing, that prayer doesn't reduce the survival of cancer patients. There was a silly study produced, I think it was about 2 years ago. Lots of studies of not very good studies, I have to say, but kind of clumsy and half-done studies. But nevertheless, they kind of pointed the way and showed that prayer does seem to have some effect. It can work. It can be important. And then some big pompous study was done, which I don't think was done certainly with open-mindedness by any means, but it sort of proved, I was supposed to have proved that prayer is a waste of time in cancer survival. You have to watch all these stories, ladies and gentlemen, because, big business and pharma out there is busy trying to trash every alternative. They don't want you to do anything that would reduce your intake of drugs, especially don't go and get healthy and get cured again. That would be awful because it means they can't sell you so many drugs. So they're often bringing out stories saying, oh, don't take vitamins, they're a waste of time, or antioxidants will kill you, prayer's a waste of time, the only thing that works is chemotherapy. As I keep saying, this has a lot more to do with sales and marketing and really has very little at all to do with medical science. So don't be put off by that. The fact is that even if you took the argument line, well, it's clearly and categorically showing that it doesn't shorten the life of a person, extend the life of a person with cancer. What does that matter if it improves the quality of life? It isn't all just about survival and years. If you lived an extra 6 months because you didn't pray, but that was spent in bed with tubes stuck up every hole, I could see very little point in that. And you could hardly say that was a result or triumph for the cancer therapy, or hardly a defeat for prayer, if by prayer and sharing and your beliefs that you were able to ride above what you were experiencing. But actually, it does get better than that. As I said, you can simply study people who go to church. You don't go to church just to sit there. Hey, you go to church to pray, I hope. And that people who go to church and pray clearly and categorically have better survival against things like cancer and heart disease. So it's kind of fudging the figures a bit when you separate out prayer and say prayer on its own. And of course, one of the things they did was study largely people who were praying for distant strangers. I'm not sure that that's all that powerful. Absent prayer, or it's sometimes called distance healing by people like our Flora Powers. I think it has a place, but it's on very shaky ground scientifically. Even if you believe it, it's hard to prove. But I think what's the important point that mustn't get missed is the person praying themselves. It doesn't matter if the whole of your city is praying on your behalf. What will do you the most good is if you pray yourself. Because prayer is really your dialogue with the higher powers. A friend of mine years ago, about 10 or 15 years ago, gave me a very good definition of prayer, which was it's sorting out your own confusion. Okay, well, there's a lot more to say on this topic. I'll probably say some of it in dribs and drabs in the future, but I'm afraid that we are actually running out of time. We're into the last few seconds, so I hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for the couple of callers who helped me out there. I'm glad we got some calls. Maybe it was all just so interesting and positive, but questions are always welcome. And I'll talk to you again next week. This is The Naked Doctor signing off.